A small galaxy of astronomers is gathering today in Washington. 3,000 astronomers are sharing exciting discoveries, such as a new map of the strange dark matter that surrounds our Milky Way galaxy. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
From way out in space, our home galaxy would look pretty much like a flat disk with spiral arms. But that's just what you could see, the bright stars. Scientists believe the Milky Way is actually embedded in a much bigger cloud, or halo, of so-called dark matter. And that's invisible. Astrophysicist David Law says scientists think this mysterious dark matter must be there because they can see the effects of its gravity as it pulls on the orbits of stars and galaxies.
While we might not be able to see the dark matter, it's vitally important, a component of our galaxy. It makes up the bulk of what the actual stuff is in our galaxy, oftentimes greater than 70%, or in many cases greater than 90% of the total mass of a galaxy is in this dark matter.
Law currently works at the University of California, Los Angeles. He wondered, if you could see the cloud of dark matter enveloping the Milky Way, what would it look like? What shape would it be? He knew he could get clues from how the dark matter alters the paths of dwarf galaxies and clusters of stars as they orbit the Milky Way.
And based on the shape of those paths, we can say what the shape of the dark matter itself has to be.
Now, you can't actually watch a dwarf galaxy go all the way around our Milky Way. That would take about a billion years. But Law and his colleagues used a kind of trick to reconstruct the path of one orbiting galaxy.
As it flies around the Milky Way, tidal forces from the Milky Way are shredding stars out of it into streams that trail behind it and even go ahead of it along its orbit.
Law says these streams of stars are like a trail of breadcrumbs showing the orbiting galaxy's path around the Milky Way. From that, they could figure out the shape of the big cloud or halo of dark matter that surrounds our galaxy. He says you can picture the bright, visible part of our Milky Way as a flat, round dinner plate.
And if you picture that sitting inside a large beach ball, then that represents the dark matter halo. And if you then came along to that beach ball and put one hand on one side and one hand on the other and squeezed it, that's something like we think the dark matter is. It's squeezed along that direction, and the dinner plate of the disk of the Milky Way is sitting inside of it.
Law presented this new dark matter map at a major conference of the American Astronomical Society. He says it should help scientists as they try to understand the nature of dark matter, because whatever it is, it's got to be able to form this kind of squashed beach ball.
You have to have some kind of a dark matter particle which can build a halo like this, because this is generally what we see surrounding the Milky Way.
He says, at the moment, there's lots of theories about what dark matter might be, but nobody knows. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
For more than a decade, scientists have been trying to understand why certain communities report having so many kids with autism. They've looked at air pollution, contaminants in drinking water, and pesticide exposure without much success. Now a team of scientists in California has found a different explanation. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The team looked at 10 California communities with autism rates at least 70% higher than those in surrounding areas. Irva Hertz-Picciotto of the University of California, Davis, says they didn't find any local environmental problems, but she says they did identify two major risk factors. One was having a certain type of parent.
These would be parents with higher levels of education, more likely to be white, and more likely to be older within the framework of people who can reproduce.
Hertz-Picciotto says parents' age and race had a relatively small effect, but the effect of education was huge. In most areas, a child whose parents completed college was four times as likely to be diagnosed with autism as a child whose parents did not finish high school.
It doesn't necessarily mean that higher education causes autism, but that it gets you the diagnosis more frequently.
Hertz-Picciotto says that's partly because educated parents are more likely to request services for children with autism.
It may also have to do with people with more education are just better able to navigate a very complicated and possibly arcane health system.
But she says parents weren't the only factor affecting diagnosis rates.
A couple of the clusters were found actually fairly close to a treatment center in California.
She says parents near state-run treatment centers are probably more aware of autism and autism services. So you might wonder if the clusters reflect over diagnosis. Hertz-Picciotto says no. The rates were still lower than those found in communities studied by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which means lots of children are probably slipping through the cracks. Hertz-Picciotto says her study found that children of Hispanic parents, for example, were less likely than other children to receive an autism diagnosis.
It's entirely possible that families are hesitant to go to a state-funded agency if they have a member of the family who might be undocumented, for instance.
The study has implications for apparent autism clusters in other parts of the U.S. Stephen Novella, a neurologist at Yale University, says that when researchers encounter a cluster, the first thing they should ask is whether it can be explained by demographic factors.
Only once you rule all those things out, you say, okay, is there an environmental biological cause? Are we looking at a genetic cluster or an environmental trigger cluster?
Demographics might have explained an apparent cluster from the 1990s in Brick Township, New Jersey. Many parents in this predominantly white, middle-class community were convinced their kids were being harmed by something in the water. But a federal investigation found no problem. Novella says that hasn't stopped people from trying to link other autism clusters to local chemicals or pollution.
There are proponents of the environmental paradigm of autism who have, I think, jumped the gun on preliminary data and say, aha, see, this is evidence of an environmental trigger, when really that data does not exist.
Novella says if something in the environment does trigger autism, it's probably something found everywhere, not just in some communities. The new study appears in the journal Autism Research. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Just as wars over oil played a major role in 20th century history, a new book makes a pretty convincing case that many 21st century conflicts will be fought over water. The book is called, appropriately enough, Water: The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. And it argues that water is surpassing oil as the world's scarcest critical resource. The book is by journalist Stephen Solomon, and he's come in to tell us about it. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
First of all, how scarce is fresh water these days?
In the 20th century, and in fact in centuries previous, world water use has grown twice as fast as world population has. And we've now reached the limit where that trajectory can no longer continue. Suddenly, we're going to have to find a way to use the existing water resources in a far, far more productive manner than we ever did before, because there's simply not enough.
And you could make the case, I suppose, that in some ways a scarcity of water is even more worrying than a scarcity of oil, because oil, it may be a painful transition, but there are alternatives.
Totally,
not an alternative.
Totally indispensable, totally irreplaceable.
You had an amazing statistic that you cite in here, that only 2.5% of the Earth's water is fresh, and that a lot of that is locked away in glaciers and ice caps.
Most of it. We live on maybe a tiny fraction of 1% of the world's water that's in rivers and lakes, and the rest of it is frozen, although with climate change we're getting a little bit more of the glacier melt a little faster than we would like it, unfortunately.
Should water cost more? I mean, when you get your water bill every month here in the States, it's usually pretty low compared to some of the other bills, electric, gas, etc.
The short answer is yes.
Should cost more.
It should reflect its true economic value. I think in some cases it does, and in some cases where there are large political subsidies, largely in agriculture, it does not. And we in the cities are paying an awful lot, and industries are also paying an awful lot. That's unfair. It's inefficient to the allocation of water to the most productive economic ends. The second part, however, is that I think there's a feeling growing in the world that there ought to be a human right to at least a minimum amount of water that we need each day for our basic health, and that's 13 gallons. There's plenty of water in the world even in the poorest and most water-famished country, for that 13 gallons to be given for free to individuals and let them pay beyond that.
And you see a world divided into, as you put it, water haves and water have-nots.
We are, because there are parts of the world that are temperate world with populations are fairly modest, like the United States and Europe, which have ample water if we're smart about how we use it to make the adjustments necessary. But there are large portions of the world that simply don't have enough water for sanitation, for their economic growth, for food. So the world is polarizing between water haves and have-nots. Those on one side of the sanitary divide or have to import food or find a way to make other arrangements to get food. And that's one of the reasons the world order is shifting to reflect those necessities.
Let me ask you about some specific countries that obviously have water issues in their own right, but also are critical issues for the U.S. in terms of national security for the U.S., economic interests. One country that's obviously the biggest one, and I assume that means it has correspondingly big water problems, is China.
Absolutely. China has about one-fifth per capita, per person, the amount of water that we do in the United States. They are a water-stressed country. And the rate of growth with their population, plus all the pollution that they've got, which is far, far greater than what we've got, makes them a very high-risk water nation. Whether or not their economic growth can continue at the rate that it has largely depends on whether they can get control of their water problems. Now, they are trying to move water where they have a little bit of excess water in the south up to the arid north, which is one of the most water-famished regions of the world. And that's where they have a lot of their coal resources, a lot of very fertile land for wheat growing. And they've got these water moving projects that are massive from the south to the north that are very high risk. If China gets it right, of course, that will take off great pressure from the need to import food. If China's out there importing food, as they have on occasion, then the price of food is going to go up, of wheat and grains and rice, etc. And you don't know what the repercussions are going to be, but it's going to be a lot of failed states out there. And that's a breeding ground, as we know, for disease and terrorism and things that reverberate around the world.
One other country I wanted to ask you about, which is Pakistan. You have a line I'd love to quote to you. You write, "Consider what will happen in water-distressed, nuclear-armed, terrorist-besieged, overpopulated, heavily irrigation-dependent, and already politically unstable Pakistan when its single water lifeline, the Indus River, loses a third of its flow from the disappearance of its glacial water source." A third of its flow.
That's a third of its flow. That's, of course, accelerated by climate change. And it shows generally the problem that climate change is accelerating and exacerbating the water problems of the world.
These two go hand in hand.
Yeah. Pakistan's problem is their population is growing 30% over the next 20 years or so, and their water flows are going to diminish by 30%. Back in April, we had the Taliban break out of the territories and enter into Bunair within 25 miles of the Tarbela Dam, which if they got control of that dam, which produces most of the hydroelectricity and irrigation of that country, would effectively give them a chokehold on that nation.
Amid all this doom and gloom and some of the pretty terrifying scenarios we've been talking about, one promising development that you point out is that the U.S., Western countries in general, so far aren't scarce in water and have the potential to, if they get things right, not face tremendous problems.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Our water use between 1900 and 1975 actually tripled relative to population growth, ninefold increase. Since 1975 to the present day, it is flatlined, and we still had a population increase of about 30%, and our GDP continued to grow. So it's an amazing increase in water productivity. It happened because basically the Clean Water Act and the other regulations came in and said, we've got to start to use water more appropriately, more preciously.
Is this model what the U.S. is doing? Is that something that other countries can follow? I mean, is it something that applies elsewhere?
Once the technologies are developed, we'll be able to apply those to other nations. That could be a big help. But a lot of the problem still is going to be organizational on the ground because water problems are not the same across the board. Everybody's got different geographical conditions, hydrological problems. It's a very complicated problem.
That's Stephen Solomon talking about his new book, Water. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
The nation's economic woes have been particularly hard on the dairy industry. Milk prices are at historic lows, and many dairy farmers are going bankrupt. Still, some farmers have found a way to survive. They've gone organic. NPR's Kathleen Masterson visited an organic family farm in northern Vermont.
At this hour, well before dawn, the only light around is coming from the barn. Tim McShillow and his teenage son, Max, are milking the herd, hooking each cow up to a pump which sends the milk to a central stainless steel tank. The barn smells like cow breath and hay. Tim's wife, Kristen Dellert, is bottle feeding the 9 baby cows, including the one born in the pasture a few hours ago.
We're milking about 42 right now. It takes me about an hour and a half to milk.
For 3 years now, Tim and Kristen have been running an organic farm. That means the cows have to get feed grown without pesticides. They can't have antibiotics or growth hormones either. And for at least 3 months a year, the cows have to be out on pasture.
I drive out there and I'll sit and have my coffee and call them. I'll call them and they'll slowly get up. I'll have to get out and roust a few up. And then they slowly make their way to the barn. Hello, Sassy. Hello, Sassy. Ooh.
The gingerbread's telling me the best. I love you best. It's all Christmas special.
The family home is tucked amid the low green hills of Coventry, Vermont. From the breakfast table, they can see the cows grazing out back. This farm is making it now, but it wasn't always. A few years ago, Tim and Kristen tried running a conventional dairy.
Well, actually, we moved up here from Connecticut because Tim wanted to be a dairy farmer. And as a speech pathologist, I could work just about anywhere.
That was in 2000. Right away, Kristen says, they realized it was going to be a lot of work. Hands-on work.
The first time I went into the barn and Tim says to me, that cow is in labor over there, you need to check her. No, put a glove on and make sure the nose and feet are coming out. And I'm like, I have a master's degree.
Kristen learned how to birth a baby cow and many other dairy chores. Through it all, she kept her full-time day job. But still, they weren't making enough to live on.
Tim said, you know, we're working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we don't get to set the price for our product. He said, this is crazy. So we sold the cows, and Tim did his own construction business for a while, excavating business. I kept working.
But after a couple of years with an empty barn, they decided to try again. This time, they would go organic. One reason was the money. These days, conventional farmers are actually getting paid less for their milk than it costs them to produce it.
They're losing their shirts, basically, just to stay in the business.
Meanwhile, organic farmers are selling their milk for a slim profit. They're getting about a dollar more per gallon than conventional. So you might think all conventional farms would be going organic right now. But Kristen and Tim say it's not for everybody. For one thing, you have to know your cows pretty well. Their son Max can name every cow, even from across the pasture.
And then we have Bean, who's Coffee's baby, and then Glaze, who was Donut's baby.
And Lisa Marie, who's Presley's baby.
If a cow is getting sick, they know right away. That's important, because organic farmers can't give their animals antibiotics. It's a lot of work, and it's expensive. The organic feed costs more, and so do the organic remedies for sick cows. But Kristen says it's worth it.
We actually think they're healthier because we find they're under less stress because they get to go out. Cows love being out on pasture. They're meant to eat grass. Right. So anything else that you give them puts them under stress.
Tim and Kristen have had a lot of help learning how to run an organic farm. They're part of a co-op called Organic Valley. It helps by marketing and distributing the milk. Kristen says being part of a co-op allows each farm to be more than just a milk factory.
Because it truly does give farmers an alternative in terms of how they're treated and what's being done with our milk.
Still, in today's economy, even organic farmers are feeling the pinch. Tim and Kristen's dairy is making just enough for both of them to be full-time farmers, but they've had to make some cutbacks.
We've let our hired help go because we have to reduce our costs. So now it's just the three of us.
They've had to postpone plans to expand, but still Tim and Kristen feel lucky their dairy is in the black, and they trust the organic movement will weather the economic downturn. Kathleen Masterson, NPR News.
In this country, President Obama is promoting green jobs. They're supposed to help both the environment and the economy, but it turns out that new green jobs may simply replace older jobs. NPR's Chris Arnold has the latest report in our series, New Jobs for a New Decade.
Many old factories around the country now sit dark and empty. But at a once defunct Polaroid film factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, the lights are on again. And a new industry is rising up inside the ruins of an old one.
Well, we make what's called plastic solar cells. We call it powered plastic.
Rick Hess is the CEO of Canarca. It's a company that makes solar panels, but not like any you've probably seen before. These are thin, flexible plastic sheets. They're lightweight, and some are transparent, so they can be built into windows to let homes or office buildings generate their own solar power. Or the material can be sewn onto a bag or briefcase. And even something that small will generate electricity.
It's enough to charge cell phones or iPods or things like that.
Oh, really? So you could charge your cell phone?
Oh, you can clearly charge your cell phone. I have a bag that I use today that I use to charge my cell phone.
The equipment at this factory used to make big sheets of Polaroid film. Canarca converted it so that these same machines are now churning out these film-like solar panels. And the company's hired back about 20 of the former Polaroid workers to run the factory. So it's given new green jobs to workers who had been laid off. Mike Page is an electrician and machine operator.
You know, I invested my whole career at Polaroid, and then I thought it was over. And now I feel renewed, and I feel like I have a whole new future.
Green jobs are a very big deal in Washington. President Obama has said that he wants to create 5 million new green jobs over 10 years.
The nation that leads in clean energy will be the nation that leads the world. I want America to be that nation.
And it's definitely an attractive idea. So if you want the country to go green, when at the same time it needs a lot more jobs, green jobs seem like the perfect solution. But
even if we hit numbers like 5 million jobs that people talk about, and that's quite plausible, that can only be a very limited piece of the puzzle in a country with several hundred million people.
Michael Levy is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says proponents often only talk about the jobs that will be created, not the jobs that will be lost. And the economy is a big interconnected system. So here's an example. The country only needs so much electricity, but if more of that comes from wind power or solar power, less is going to come from coal. So some coal miners would lose their jobs. Levy says anytime the government pushes the economy in a given direction, you'll gain jobs in some areas and lose them in others.
Let's say I add 5 million jobs and I lose 4 million jobs elsewhere, and it's over 10 years. Within the grander scheme of things, it's other elements of economic policy that are going to change people's lives.
There's also the question of what gets counted as a, quote, green job. The numbers get very mushy here. What about electricians who already have a job but who start installing more efficient furnaces? Should those be counted as new green jobs? Levy thinks that many green jobs will really just be existing jobs that are shifted into this category. Still, other experts see green jobs as a lot more important.
This is at the center of the future of American competitiveness.
Bracken Hendricks is a senior fellow at the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. He says, take the global auto industry. If companies here in the U.S. can come up with the best electric car technologies,
we're talking about who is going to own the growth of the auto industry globally. In China, they're about to go from 65 million cars on the road to 300 million cars on the road.
Basically, people's views on green jobs depend on their vision of the future. Congressman Ed Markey authored clean energy and green jobs legislation that was recently passed by the House.
We have to think of this as the next great job-creating sector in the same way that we put the correct telecommunications policies on the books in the 1990s that led to an explosion of made-in-America brands, Google, eBay, Amazon.
In the shorter term, the Obama administration is interested in giving Americans incentives to insulate their homes. The idea is to put thousands of contractors to work with insulation and caulk guns. So it's being called Cash for Caulkers. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Our series New Jobs for a New Decade continues tomorrow with a look at healthcare workers.
The road to success in Hollywood does not normally lead through Harvard Medical School. But there are exceptions, and Valerie Weiss hopes to be one of them. After earning a Ph.D. from Harvard, she's left the lab for a different career. NPR's Joe Palka has her story.
When she was in graduate school, Valerie Weiss studied an enzyme called arginine methyl transferase. Never mind what that does, just understand that it's important in cells. Weiss was trying to figure out the enzyme's three-dimensional shape.
The idea is that how something is shaped has a huge effect on its function, because really molecules are just kind of like Legos fitting together, interacting, and then, you know, chemistry happens and the molecules change.
We're sitting in an outdoor cafe a few blocks south of Hollywood. Weiss enjoyed her graduate work because it helped her understand how the cells inside our bodies function.
I think the whole reason I even went into science is because I love to know how things work, and the answer to a why question just would lead to another why question. At least that's what my mom tells me I was like.
Okay, so you're understanding the nature of the universe, and you're a why kind of person, and you're always asking questions, and then you give it up. What's up with that?
I know. What is up with that? I ask myself that all the time. My parents certainly ask themselves that all the time.
She gave up science because she had a career itch she needed to scratch. Weiss says science tends to be very specialized these days, and her interests are more eclectic.
At the same time that I was interested in science, I was really interested in theater. And I think for the same reason, just why do people relate to each other the way they do? Why is the world the way it is? I think I like asking that question on every level.
That's not to say she's abandoned science. In fact, the film she's making now is set in part in the lab.
The film's called Losing Control, and it's about a female scientist who wants proof that her boyfriend's the one.
Okay, it's a bit of a stretch. Science is a blunt tool when it comes to matters of the heart. But this is a comedy, and Weiss says the film is definitely science-y.
Science is absolutely interwoven in every aspect of this film. It's going to be a funny, funny movie that happens to be about scientists.
Weiss has several financial backers for her film, but this is still a low-budget affair.
All right, here we go. Ready, ready?
Still, Jamie? Visit the set, and it looks like a Hollywood movie, albeit on a smaller scale.
Okay, so we'll go for a full rehearsal here?
Weiss and her crew have taken over a lab at Xencor, a biotech company in Monrovia, California.
Super far off for what? Kelly's going to bring it right over to you right now. Right, Kelly?
Strong lights are everywhere. Electric cables snake across the floor.
Quiet, please.
Weiss and her cameraman, Jamie Ehrman, confer about the best angle for the next scene.
Okay, guys.
Weiss is producer, writer, and director of Losing Control. They're shooting a key scene, and there have been a lot of takes. Now they're ready to try again.
All sound quiet, please.
Action. Oh, sorry.
Weiss jumps the gun a bit. Then it is time.
Action!
Weiss asked me not to record while they were shooting. As I said, this is a key scene. She doesn't want to give anything away. Science doesn't show up in a lot of films, not real science anyway. Valerie Weiss wants to change that.
Why not science? It is fun, it is sexy, and, you know, it's a really rich, untapped area that I'm excited to explore.
And maybe show that scientists are smart people with problems and ideas and dreams, just like everyone else. Joe Palka, NPR News.